This is Phantom Power.
And this is difficult given the habits of the discipline or disciplines that I'm engaging with, I think, is that we can't point to a particular set of sounds as inherently emancipatory or radical or having a kind of liberating potential. There's a need to think carefully about that.
Welcome to another episode of Phantom Power. I'm Mac Haygood. Today I'm bringing you an episode with a scholar who I feel is just an intellectual kindred spirit. We have a lot of the same interests, we've written on similar topics, and she's someone that I've learned a lot from. My guest is Marie Thompson, associate professor at the Open University in the UK. Marie is a theorist of noise, and she has been one of the key thinkers in integrating the study of sound with the study of affect. Starting around the early 2000s, a number of scholars began to feel there was a tool missing in the toolbox of cultural scholarship. We had plenty of ways to talk about ideology and representation and rhetoric and identity, but what about sensation? How is it that a feeling like joy or panic can sweep through a room without a word being uttered? By what mechanism does a life develop a kind of texture or a feeling over time? Affect studies is a field interested in these questions, interested in how the world affects us. Words can produce affective states, but affect isn't reducible to words. So I think it's easy to see why affect theory has been so attractive to sound and music scholars. And Marie Thompson's work has used affect as a tool to pick at one of the densest theoretical knots in sound studies, noise. Noise is a notorious concept that means so many different things to so many different people. And in this conversation, Marie examines noise through the affect theory of Gilles Deleuze and Baruch Spinoza, as well as the systems theory of Michel Serre. And we're going to talk about her critique of acoustic ecology and a rather public debate she had with sound scholar Christoph Cox. And if you don't know what any of that means, just hang tight. We're going to break it down. And this is only the first half of our lengthy conversation that I'm presenting in this episode. In the second half, we discuss Marie's recent research on tinnitus. I've heard from several people who find our tinnitus content really helpful, and I don't want to put that behind a paywall. So what I'm going to do is share it in our Patreon feed at the free level. So all you have to do is go to patreon.com/phantompower and sign up as a free member. You'll get access to that episode in your podcast app of choice, as well as other content that I plan to drop this summer when we are on break with the podcast. So that's at patreon.com/phantompower. So, how does one become a respected theorist of noise? Perhaps unsurprisingly for Marie Thompson, it started with a love of edgy music. Marie grew up in the south of England, in Kent. It was a pretty slow life there. There was the seaside and the countryside, but it wasn't the most exciting place to be a teenager interested in esoteric music. If she wanted to go to a show in London, it took her nearly 3 hours to get back by train that night. It wasn't until Marie was an undergrad at the University of Liverpool that she was truly able to immerse herself in music.
It was the degree in music and popular music, or there was a slash separating them. So I ended up having this education that was a bit of a mixed bag in terms of I was learning stuff from popular music studies, but I was also learning, I guess, the kind of more traditional capital M music of a university department. But I had the great fortune of studying composition with a composer called James Wishart. And I think his influence was really formative. He was really, you know, his work really had this modernist intensity. And I was already interested in sort of, I guess, music at its limits and quite intense and I don't want to say difficult music because that sounds obnoxious, but but you know, kind of noisy and timbre-y music with a complex timbre. My background was as an oboist as well, and you know, I kind of think the oboe is an instrument that draws you to both timbre and limits. It's an instrument that likes keeping life difficult. So I was studying with James, who was opening up the sound world to me, but I was also taking classes with people like Anahid Kasabian, who was really formative for my thinking about sound and affect. And I was also playing in bands. You know, Liverpool at the time had a really vibrant underground music scene, which was also contributing to my education. I feel like that moment, I say moment, you know, it was 3-4 years, but it was formative in ways that I'm only just starting to really understand now, I think, now that I can look back and see those connections. But yeah, like playing in bands, playing sort of loud dissonant music in bands, plus having this education in quite what was at the time quite an unusual music department, in that it was quite expansive to its approach to music. It wasn't all sort of historical musicology. Not that there's anything wrong with historical musicology, but it wasn't just that. It was quite expansive in what it was trying to do within the rubric of music. And yeah, I think that set me up for thinking about sound more broadly in some of the ways that I try to.
So Marie was studying composition with James Wishart. She was also studying with Anahid Kasabian, who at the time was doing research on sound and affect, which would become her book Ubiquitous Listening. And Marie was playing in noisy bands by night. She was hooked. And so she immediately applied to graduate school.
I did a PhD at Newcastle University, and I was in the music department there. And again, the music department there was important to me, but also so was the city and its wider music and artistic community, I would say. And what was great about Newcastle at that time, and I think continues, is that there was quite a porous boundary between the music department in the university and the wider underground music culture there. There were people like Will Edmonds, who plays in Yeah You, who were really instrumental in kind of ensuring those boundaries remain porous. And now there's Mariam Rezaei, who's there as well, who's still into ensuring that, you know, things flow both ways, I guess, or certainly trying to make that the case. And yeah, like Newcastle is an incredible place to be writing about noise and thinking about noise, because it has a very strong and rich history of noise music, experimental music, just underground musics in general.
The first time I came across Marie's work, I was working on my own PhD dissertation. I had gotten wind of affect theory and immediately saw how it could help me talk about the personal and social dynamics of the white noise machines and noise-canceling headphones that I was studying. I started looking for any books out there that used these theories to talk about sound. First, I found Steve Goodman's book, Sonic Warfare, which was the first thing that I read that was really putting affect theory and music and sound more generally together. And then I saw your edited volume that you did with Ian Biddle, Sound, Music, Affect. And I was like, oh my gosh, like that was the one that I could really relate to, because you were dealing with like the exact same theorists I was interested in. And you had already thought this through. And I was like, looked at the back of the book and I said, oh my God, this is a PhD candidate. She's not even, she hasn't even gotten her degree yet. I was like, who is this person? This is, you know, so can you talk a little bit about like what you were doing in grad school? How did you become so productive that you had an edited volume before you had a PhD?
I mean, I feel like there's a kind of a state of academia answer to that, isn't there? Where it's like, well,
yeah,
probably the complex psychodrama of wanting to be a good girl in you know, I was super young. I went straight through from undergraduate to MA to PhD without a break. And
oh my God.
Yeah, like that book in many ways symbolizes so many different things to me. You know, what was I doing editing a book while writing my PhD? That seems like a ridiculous thing to do now.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane.
Why was I doing that? And, you know, I feel like that's a good question. Why was I doing that? But, you know, I was very fortunate that the authors that contributed to that collection were great and really experienced in some cases and were just excited about sharing their ideas.
As Marie put it, there was just something in the air at that time. A lot of us were grasping at ways to talk about what sound and music and noise do to us, how they affect us, and how that relates to the politics of sound and noise. Thompson and Biddle's volume was one important space where this nascent conversation was taking shape. Marie's other important project at the time was, of course, her own dissertation, which eventually became her 2017 book, Beyond Unwanted Sound, Noise, Affect, and Aesthetic Moralism. I wanted to dig into that book and some of its guiding theorists in this conversation, but first, I asked Marie about a couple of themes I saw operating in that book. You address these things in your book, Beyond Unwanted Sound. You know, there's, for one thing, the problem of noise being this sort of floating signifier. Noise means so many things to so many different people. And then there's a second problem that noise is often, almost always really, doing some kind of work for the person that wants to theorize it or write about it or talk about it. Some kind of almost moral work, right? Like noise is either something really good or something really bad. I believe you called this aesthetic moralism. Do you want to maybe unpack a little bit of these issues around noise and what you were trying to address with that book?
Yeah, sure. So I think to go back to some of what we were talking about earlier with my relationship to music and the use of noise in music as well, this perhaps explains why someone like me might feel dissatisfaction with the definition of noise as unwanted sound. So this mm-hmm. notion that noise is of the ear of the beholder and what defines it is its unwantedness. And for me, starting from a position where noise has often been used as a musical resource or something interrogated through art or sound, you know, this didn't feel like a particularly satisfactory conclusion. And at the other side of this was at that time when I was starting to start thinking about noise more critically and more theoretically, there was a body of work coming out where, and again, this was kind of mirrored in practice too, where noise was seen as this radical, extreme, awesome force that was kind of transcendental and was a limit experience. And I also found that to be somewhat unsatisfactory in that noise often is none of those things. And
right.
Yeah, and even within noise music, which often is about limits and the extreme, there's also a whole body of practice that isn't really interested in that. And, you know, one of the criticisms that I've seen come from sort of people active in noise music scenes is that there are all these theorists who are writing about noise music as this kind of limit or this idea of extremity or whatever, and that's not actually what the intention is, or that's not really what the interest is. There's a different conversation there about, you know, the relationship between musicians and theorists and whether actually we need to take musicians at what they think they're doing, or, you know, but I guess we can kind of park that.
Well, I mean, this is you're reminding me of like Jacques Attali's Noise, the Political Economy of Music, which kind of seems to preordain the role that noise plays, you know, as being this radical thing that changes the landscape and then it gets incorporated into the status quo once again. Like, I just never had much tolerance for for that book or that any of those ideas. It just seemed like this very schematic way of thinking about noise that, like you say, doesn't map on to many experiences of either music or noise that I've had.
Yeah. I mean, Atelier is kind of fascinating. That's such a weird book. And, you know, it's...
But so influential.
So influential. So just
taken as gospel. And I just don't... I never got
that. Yeah. I mean, I think... It's that thing of, there's a question here of why do theories get taken up? And I think there's an ambiguity in that text that is actually very productive and is perhaps why people really seize on it. You know, improvisers like it because the final chapter is about music of the future and there's certain things that can be read as endorsing improvisation. There's a sense that, you know, there's something hopeful about music in this. There's a kind of music as structure of mediation. And, you know, I feel like there's a risk that I'm going to end up doing a deep dive on Atelier here and the kinds of margins that move in that text. But I guess that there's a sense, you know, even more basically from a sound studies perspective, that people get excited because it's about history, but it includes sound. And there's a sense that, you know, the historical is for listening too. And I can see why people in sound studies read that and are like, This is my guy. This is who I need to engage with.
Yeah.
So yeah.
But it's also a very Marshall McLuhan type way of historicizing sound.
Yeah. And it's very top down. It's light on the details. It's, you know, it's a general model, which, you know, I would say that what my book is doing is also providing a general model, but I try and situate that model and say, you know, there's a specific interest that is guiding this, and that's to do with practice and to do with noise music and to do with noise's use as a musical resource. And that's conditioning the general model of noise that I'm seeking to develop in that book.
Yeah. So instead of the aesthetic moralism of an R. Murray Schafer, noise bad, you know, hi-fi soundscapes are the good.
Yeah.
Soundscapes that we can hear everything clearly and they're not occluded by noise, and then, or something more like this liberatory version of noise, bring the noise, you know, this Atelier thing that noise is this revolutionary disruption. You are interested in putting something else on the table. So maybe we can move on to what that is. What were you trying to do?
Yeah, so I was using sort of affect theory, mainly coming from Spinoza or Deleuze's reading of Spinoza. I always feel like I need to qualify this because a lot of the political theorists who are, or political philosophers who are familiar with Spinoza would not recognize Spinoza from what I'm writing. And I was also engaging with Michel Serre, who is in turn very influenced by information theory and is drawing on Claude Shannon and Warren Weaver's work. And I'm using this work to try and think about noise as something that is both necessary and transformative. So this again is coming from media theory and information theory, which suggests that noise is something that is necessary in terms of communication and connection and making relations. You know, you and I, Mac, are talking through two computers and a piece of software and microphones, not cameras because the bandwidth can't cope with that. And at all of these points, those forms of mediation are shaping and transforming what is sent and what is received and leaving an impression. So the sound of my voice, for example, differs in the room that I'm sitting in, which, you know, itself is shaped by the walls, the temperature, the, you know, all kinds of things, the carpet. You know, my voice transforms as it's going to the microphone, which introduces other timbral qualities to the signal, and on and on and on. And at every point, the separation of noise and signal is kind of an abstraction because we can't really imagine one without the other. And this was the idea that I was trying to start with, the idea that noise is the necessary relation to relations. It's not something external in a straightforward sense of inside and outside, or music and noise, or wanted and unwanted. It's something that's present whether you notice it or not, or whether you want it or not, because it's necessary. So that was the assumption that I was starting with. And so,
And Sarah is saying that we tend to think of noise as an interruption of a system, and it certainly can be that, but noise is also intrinsic to the system itself. It has to be, which is actually something Claude Shannon also
sure,
said, right?
Yeah. And Sarah is drawing on Shannon, but also I think making things a bit more fluid.
Yeah, he's emphasizing that middle space that Shannon kind of doesn't think very much about. Shannon thinks about the sender and the receiver and this kind of linear transmission of information across this, I think what Sarah called the excluded middle, right?
Yeah.
Like and the middle for Shannon is just the place where the noise lives, and we want to minimize that. But Sarah was much more interested in the productive aspects of that middle. And in fact, the noise in that channel can be a signal in certain contexts, right? Or it could be productive of an entirely new system. It could interrupt one system, but in so doing, create a new system of some kind.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And, you know, I think it's always really important to remember why Shannon wanted to minimize noise. And this is something that people like Jonathan Stern have been really keen to emphasize, is that the general model of communication that Shannon came up with, it was informed by the economic imperatives of Bell Labs and the desire to develop efficient communication. So the need to minimize noise is an economic imperative. It's something that's coming from the context of that work. It's not a universal concern. So I think mm-hmm. that's something that's really worth recognizing. Now, Sayre, as a philosopher, has very different concerns. So he is able to have a slightly more open perspective in this. Sarah's tricky because there are other books of Sarah where noise is very much the enemy and is very much something that is derided. Whereas in The Parasite, which mm-hmm. is this text where a lot of these ideas are playing out, Sarah has a much more interested idea of noise and is interested in how these relations are both necessary and changeable. You know, there's this great line that systems work because they do not work. And this idea of actually, it is, you said it's the excluded middle, but for Sarah, noise isn't of the middle, it's also of the offset, it's of the start, because we can never really separate signal and noise. So even the kind of linear model that we tend to have in mind when we think of Shannon and Weaver's, you know, he is saying noise appears in the middle in that model, but actually it's there at the start. It can't be escaped.
One of the few times that I really engaged with him was my friend Travis Bogan and I wrote this article about the role of fans' voices, of fan noise in the NFL, National Football League, the American football. And there was a time in the sport where the league was looking to penalize crowds for making too much noise when the visiting team's offense was on the field, right? Because that crowd noise was a disruption of the gameplay on the field.
Yeah. Right?
And so they tried to regulate that noise. They tried to minimize that noise to sort of maximize the signal of gameplay, so to speak. But a really interesting thing happened. First of all, fans completely rebelled against that. But secondly, they gradually realized that this so-called noise of the crowd was actually a really productive signal in itself. And then it became part of the story, right? It became part of the story of the game. And the TV network started to realize, oh, we could actually mic this crowd noise up. And especially when surround sound came in, we can send it to the rear channels of the speakers in the home setting to make it a more immersive experience for the people being there. And to me, that was like this thing, like this crowd noise is sort of inherent, right? Like the people just spontaneously, it's kind of an affect of the joy, the excitement, the rage of being a sports audience member, but then also it turned out to be a signal in itself that could be profitably used by capitalism.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great example of why, again, I find some of the attempts to position noise as a site of autonomy or freedom, you know, there is a need to caveat that with the fact that there are lots of ways that capital finds uses of noise, as it does with silence and quietude as well. So I think one of the themes of the book is that it's, and this is difficult given the habits of the discipline or disciplines that I'm engaging with, I think, is that we can't point to a particular set of sounds as inherently emancipatory or radical or having a kind of liberating potential. There's a need to think carefully about that. And, you know, I think it's easy to see noise as, or it's not easy, but, you know, it's easy to see noise in some ways as this resistive site.
Yes.
But that requires us to kind of discount or interrogate, well, what do we do about all these occasions where noise and the various things that it stands for is capitalized on?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's no essential nature to noise, positive or negative, in part because it's relational. And maybe that's a good segue into the other influence that you mentioned, which is, you know, Spinoza's ethics through Deleuze. Could we maybe walk through that a little bit and how that relates to sound?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been thinking about Spinoza because, again, with theory, there are trends and then things come and go. And it's kind of easy to look back at stuff you wrote a few years ago and be like, oh, you know, this was all about Deleuze and Spinoza. And that was kind of fashionable at that time. And now it's no longer as fashionable. And maybe I need to just disown this all. But I think that I think there's a reason why, you know, I was drawn to that work. And with Spinoza, it's probably worth noting that in Spinoza's work, affect is not just synonymous with feelings or emotions. It's not just about what the subject feels as emotion. It's not necessarily the same as affection, but it's also about forces of change and relating to the capacity to act and be acted on. So there's this notion of capacity and ability. And there's something quite resonant there with thinking about systems, and to think about noise is to think about systems or relations or infrastructures, you know, certainly in the approach that I take. And I think there's what's particularly prescient for people interested in sound and music is that Spinoza enables us, I think, to think about these things as part of a wider series of relations. So thinking about the technological, the ecological, the social, the aesthetic, kind of in relation to one another. I think there's a capacity in his work for that. But I've also been, you know, I've been thinking more and more on this about why Spinoza, what's useful in Spinoza, not to just have a kind of horrible instrumental approach to these theorists. But I also think there's something in here about harm and damage, which sound and music studies, I think, has often struggled with. You know, I think even though there's some really fantastic scholarship that deals with the ways that sound and music are bound up, including your own work, bound up with conditions of exploitation and oppression, I still think there is a challenge to articulating music's capacity to be harmful and sound's capacity to be harmful in ways that are not just a kind of top-down moralist kind of, we'll probably come on to this later, but, you know, loud sound is bad for you, everyone must wear earplugs. I think there's something in Spinoza that allows a careful interrogation about the bad side of these phenomena that I think is perhaps useful. I don't know, what do you think? you think about these things too.
Yeah. I think the thing that you highlighted about his focus on the capacity to act, right? That basically he's thinking about bodies and the term body writ very large, could be human, non-human, organic, like what it could be, a lot of different things, what a body could be, and that bodies are constantly affecting one another. And from the perspective of a particular body, those interactions are either diminishing the ability of that body to act or enhancing it. And so, as I understand it, a joyful affect would be the feeling of having, feeling enlivened and enabled to do more, or conversely, feeling diminished, feeling disabled by some other body, some other set of relations, is kind of a sad affect. And just having that kind of non-moralist, non-judgmental, stepping back, kind of looking at the material relations, but also the psychic relations, because what's really, I think, so helpful about this system is it transcends what we would, I don't know, transcends is the wrong word, but it engages with both what we would think of as the mental and the material.
Yeah, and I think that's really useful to highlight, because I think there was a tendency to see Spinoza as, you know, it's the body and it's mind. And there's, I think there's been, in a kind of rush to see this as a non-Cartesian model, the mind has kind of been thrown out a bit. And actually, you're right that there is something about the mind in this that needs to be retained, you know, and Spinoza understanding it plays a really important role. And this, you know, in the ethics, understanding is key to what he sees as a kind of ethical enhancement or a joyous life. It's not just about maximizing what happens to you. It's also about understanding these affective relations. And that plays a key role.
Because when we misunderstand those affective relations, we tend to do things that are harmful and unethical.
We attribute them to the wrong things as well, or we have a limited.
Yeah.
And you know, for Spinoza, it's inevitable that we don't really have the full picture. That we, you know, our understanding is, we can't have the kind of position of ultimate understanding, but it's an issue of degrees. You know, we can improve our understanding. We can improve our understanding of acting and being affected.
An example I often, you know, use is, it's very easy to demonize the coworker in the cubicle next to you who eats loudly or something like that, right? And focus on them as the problem that's affecting you. But to perhaps have a wider understanding, you might think about, well, okay, what is the structure of this room that I've been put in? And, you know, how are we expected to maintain our attention on these very detailed things on these computer screens, but we've been placed alongside one another in this particular arrangement that generates an experience of noise? You know, it's just so tempting to attribute the noisemaker to being the individual next to us who we're mad at, right? And everything is encouraging us to think that way. And yet, I think from a Spinozan perspective, we might step back and say, okay, well, how are the bodies arranged in this space? What kinds of experiences of noise are being encourage in this setting?
Why are workers having to eat their lunch at their desk? What are the demands?
It
kind of goes back to our, why is a PhD candidate editing a collection when they've got no business to be doing that? It's a similar thing, right? You know, I think that's a good explanation and illustration of some of these things. But you know, whenever I have these conversations about noise, there's this kind of, having written a book called Beyond and Wanted Sound, there's a sense that I can never complain about noise ever again, and I have to just kind of move through the world completely unbothered by auditory experience, because I've written a book called Beyond Unwanted Sound. It's very annoying. I have regrets. But there's something interesting about the affective here, where there's that thing of, you know, even with understanding, even if you understand the structural conditions on an affective level and on a kind of an emotional level, that can still feel really annoying.
Absolutely.
You know, the other great example of this is noisy neighbors. You know, we can think, okay, the problem is poor quality housing, which in the UK is poorly insulated, the problems with the rent market, the problems with a day structured around the wage. You know, there are all these problems that contribute to experiences of neighbor noise as particularly egregious and annoying. And yet on some level, it's just annoying. You could, even with that understanding. Absolutely. And I guess that's one of the challenges for these theoretical works is, you know, how does this relate in practice as well? And in the everyday as well. And, you know, I'm sure there's a smart Spinozan answer for that as well. But yeah, I'd need to go back and read the ethics and figure out how to square that one.
No, it's such an important point, though, because, you know, with my own work, you know, that there's a critique of these ways that we use technology not to listen. And one of the things that I wanted to do is challenge the notion that media are always there to help us communicate better. I actually think they're not. But at the same time, people might think, well, oh, you're like anti-noise canceling headphones, you're anti-white noise machines. Like, no, I own all of these things, right? Like there is a difference between analyzing it and trying to be charitable towards the others who are embedded in this system alongside you and on top of you and interfering with you. It doesn't make it not annoying. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't use technology to try to diminish some of these affects, right? But I do think there is a sort of moral imperative to try to use those things. I'm trying to avoid the word mindfully. I don't know. but like ethically and thinking about their position within the system and what the knock-on effects of using these things are going to be, right? Are we just exacerbating a problem or are we actually mitigating it in a way that's going to help us deal with other people better?
Right. And I think there's that thing, isn't there, of it's one thing to use these technologies and engage with them. And I guess this resonates with some of the work I've been doing recently on, I'm interested in sort of technologies that are engaged in processes and practices of social reproduction. So things like Amazon smart speakers, I've been looking at these prenatal sound systems and
I love that work.
what a world. And things like sonic sleep aids as well, which I know that your work engages with. And it's one thing to talk about using these things and another thing to talk about the wider conditions that make these technologies possible and make these technologies a thing. Do you know what I mean?
And make them feel so necessary.
And natural as well, you know.
And natural.
Yeah, so I think there's the conversation about using these technologies is always partial because it's, you know, ultimately what it is about is a wider context in which these things become seemingly sensible technological interventions. And I think that's where some of these disjunctures occur as well. And yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky squaring these things, dealing with what happens on a individual, personal, affective level and the wider conditions and context through which these things occur. I think those tensions are in some way the point. It's difficult.
I was wondering, we've been kind of talking about these rather materialist, in many ways, conceptions of sound, right? Like in both the Serre and in Spinoza, they both engage with what we might call non-representational aspects of sound. But you've also taken issue with like certain materialist conceptions of sound. And I don't know if you feel like talking about this. We could cut it out if you don't want to. But back like in, I think it was 2017, you were in a back and forth with the sound art scholar / philosopher Christoph Cox. You wrote an article in Parallax, as did Annie Go. Do you want to talk about like the sort of critique you had of Cox's version of materialism and
what that was all about? So, I mean, again, it feels 2017, it feels like these issues that were really pressing at that time. I don't know, the theoretical, you know, at that point, object-oriented ontology was still quite an influential body of thought. And that's something that this critique was drawing on, not in a way of advocating for OOO, as it was known back then, but drawing on critiques of speculative realism and object-oriented ontology to think about the application of these critiques to some of the discourses and debates that were going on in the sonic arts and sound studies. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can call it a back and forth if you write something and then someone writes something back and then you just don't really... You write a Twitter thread and then you're just like, you know what? I've said what I've said. Let's leave it at that.
But he's got... I mean, he had this concept of sonic flux, right? It was a very influential concept. And it's this sort of idea, as you said, of sound itself. Sound is this material phenomenon outside of human perception. And to me, what I heard you doing, as I recall, and I got to, this is not entirely fresh in my mind either, but you were basically critiquing the idea that we could make claims about what that is, what sound is outside of any human perspective, and that sort of alleged objective distance is actually this sort of, you know, reimposition of a European masculinist epistemology rather than an ontology, right? So it's an epistemology in the sense that it's a way of structuring our thinking about something, but it's claiming to be the reality itself, the ontology. Is that a kind of
I think it's also about the desire itself and why, not a kind of why would you want to do this in that kind of crude sense, but the notion that we can go beyond identity, we can go beyond the social stratifications that constitute life, I guess, and have this kind of pure sound. You know, I think thinking about it in terms of purity is kind of useful, actually. You know, that desire in and of itself is bound up with, or as I trace it, sort of discourses and ontologies of whiteness. This idea of the frontier was very prevalent in that discourse, and this idea of going beyond, you know, I say this as someone who has beyond in the title of their book, but yeah, so there was this notion of getting to this itself or this beyond that, you know, has a connection to a frontier logic. And there's also, you know, there's a sense of to whom the ontological is accessible as well. And then just in general, there was the question of the exemplars, of who is exemplar of sound itself, because, you know, within this notion of sonic flux, it's the things that can give us a glimpse to it in Cox's account are particular works of sonic art. And that requires quite a particular reading of those pieces of sound art and also the compositional intentions behind it, I think. So I draw on George Lewis's critique of Cage and his discussion of what freedom means in Cage's work, for example. But ultimately within this, there's a kind of innocent or an unmarked orality that is being constructed, where we kind of have to do away with orality in this, in order to allow for this kind of pure sonic flux.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand, maybe because I am a white man, I don't know, but I understand the impulse in the sense that I sometimes remember when I was a graduate student, you know, speaking with professors who were pretty extreme social constructionists, right? And they really didn't want there to be any space where I could talk about an effect of sound on the body that wasn't socially constructed. And I was like, yeah, but you know what? If I go stand next to a jet engine, you know, on a tarmac and I don't have any ear protection, like those sound waves are going to damage my ears, right? Like, there's something not socially constructed happening there. and so, like, that there is this tricky... Now, the fact that that's the example that I draw, and, like, all of these different ways, the way I'm framing it, the words that I have to even describe that experience, like, yes, that's all completely socially constructed, but there's something I'm referring to that is in dialogue with the social, but is not completely included by it, unless we have that more expansive, you know, Sayre version of The Social, right? Where The Social includes the material.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I would be terrified to just subscribe to a real crude determinist model where everything is predetermined by identity and pre-existing structures. You know, that's definitely not what I'm trying to advocate for in that article.
But I think in Cox's letter that responded to your article, I do think that's more, that's how I read his portrayal.
Sure.
Of him, that you were denying that there is a material reality that exists.
Sure.
Outside of human experience.
Yeah, and I think there's probably, you know, I think that is, yeah, that's definitely not what neither Annie nor I were aiming for to articulate. Mm-hmm. But I think our point is that who gets to lay claim to these things and how are claims to these things made? That there's definitely that kind of you don't believe in science kind of aspect to some of the response, which that's not really where we're at. But at the same time, we've often appealed to science as this above all objective field when we know actually time and time and time again, its conclusions have been bound up with race, gender, colonialism and coloniality, you know, the exploitations of capital, you know, to kind of posit these things as neutral spaces. I just think there's better ways of doing this and engaging with the material. And
it's really interesting too, that these debates that we were having within academia, like have really become so dominant in the wider culture today, right? I mean, it was almost like that what you guys were arguing about was a harbinger of things like, I don't know, people who are saying, hey, there are just two sexes and you know, gender constructionists think there's this plethora of genders, but there's really only materially two sexes, which is definitely not true because my wife works in a clinic that works with people with developmental sexual differences. And there are definitely plenty of intersex people, a lot more than you would really realize. But anyway, like those kinds of debates, I feel very familiar. And also it's kind of interesting because the same people who are angrily waging these kinds of debates also seem to think that within the academy, we don't have these debates ourselves.
Right, right? Yeah.
Like, no, actually, we were having that one like a decade ago.
Yeah.
So this is the point in our conversation where we moved on to a different topic, which is tinnitus and hearing loss, and what we've both learned as researchers in that space, particularly around the relationship between tinnitus and the arts. It's a different topic, and yet one that still closely relates to Marie's work on affect, noise, and aesthetic moralism. We spoke for another 40 minutes about tinnitus and the different ways that people experience it. We talked about ableism in sound studies and much more, including Marie's excellent book and music recommendations. And you can hear it. Just go to patreon.com/phantompower and sign up for a free patron membership. And of course, if you'd like to be a paid member, that would be amazing. I know that 1,000 people are going to listen to this episode, but right now we only have about 20 paying patrons. So it would be amazing if you wanted to sign up for as little as $3 a month. But if you don't, that's okay too. Just come get a free Patreon account and hear Marie talk about tinnitus. And that's it for this episode of Phantom Power. Huge thanks to Marie Thompson. Our editor today was Niso Sasha. Our transcript and website is by Caitlin Fan. And our SEO and YouTube content person is Devin Ankeny. Music by Graham Gibson and yours truly. I'm Mac Haygood, and I'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.